Satipano Yasa Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Tamayang Bhagavantang Sadamang Sasangang Ime Hisakare Hiyatavahang Avopite Hiyabhipujayama Sadhano Bhante Bhagava Suchiva Parinipotopi Pachima Janata Nukampamanasa Ime Sakare Dukatapana Kalabhute Patikan Hatu Amhakak Ikavatak Hitaya Sukaya Alahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivadehi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa Itipiso Bhagava Arahaṃ Sammasambuddho Vicca-cavana-sampanno Sugato Lokavidu Anuttaro Purisadhammasavati Sata Deva Manusana Buddha Bhagava Tamahang Bhagavantang Abhipujayami Tamahang Bhagavantang Sirasanamami Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Sanditiko Akaliko Ehipasiko Opanayiko Pachyatak Veditapo Vinyuhi Tamahang Dhammang Abhipujayami Tamahang Dhammang Sirasanamami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ujjapatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Yayapatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Samichipatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Yati Dhanchatari Purisa Yugani Ata Purisa Bhugala Esa Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Adineyo Pahineyo Dakineyo Anjalikaraniyo Anutarang Punya Ketang Lokasa Tamahang Sangang Abhipujayami Tamahang Sangang Sirasanamami. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later improve, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, upward and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill wills, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, freed from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, why not hold into false use the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again.
Okey-dokey. I know, there's many in there. Okay. Those with good karma will be answered. In the teaching, whatever is of the nature to arise is the nature to cease. So this question arose and it ceased. Could you kindly advise? Does it refer to cessation of delight and craving for the five aggregates, since it is delight and craving that causes the arising of the five aggregates? Yes, but it's say when the cause stops and ceases, so does the result. So it's not just the delight and craving that causes the arising that ceases, so does the effect cease as well. I think I mentioned this before, it's the Agawachi Gota Sutta. And in there the Buddha talks about the fire, different types of fire. Would you know the fire is burning? I prefer just to adapt that simile to just a candle burning. And a candle burns because of three causes. The flame is because of the wick, the wax, and the heat. And if one of that's what causes a flame to arise. And if any one of those causes ceases, so does the flame. And the Buddha uses that, because if any one of the things which causes the arising of the five khandhas ceases, so does the five khandhas. They stop. Could you kindly advise on the light at the end of the tunnel that is often heard, experienced by near-death experience? Is that referring to the same thing as a nimitta? Yes. If a dying person follows it, will that person at least be reborn in the heavenly realms? It's hard for a person when they see a nimitta to follow it now when they're alive. Sometimes we get scared. Sometimes we don't know what to do. Sometimes we disturb it. So the opportunity to even get reborn in the heaven realm just disappears. Sometimes a nimitta, if you haven't behaved well, you haven't been kind and generous and forgiving, it means that nimitta will look a bit dirty at the end of your life. So the light you see might be a bit difficult. But that's why when a person gets nimittas on a meditation retreat, this is dying meditation. It's learning how. It's like dying 101. So you can train. Whenever you go and change a profession, you get training before they'll accept you in. When you're driving a truck or driving a car, when you're an aircraft, they give you some training first of all. When you're a policeman, they give you training. Monks get training. But we don't get any training how to die. The one important thing which is going to happen in our life, which we know will happen, we just go in there like novices, not knowing what we're supposed to do and how we're supposed to do it. And so we call this learning how to die retreat. And of course, the experts, the people who know about dying most of all, are the monks and nuns, the Buddhists. Because we die many times. You're a Christian, they only die once. So they've got no experience. Like the Buddhists have. It's only a joke, by the way. So this is actually how we learn about how to die. That nimitta, yeah. The reason it is sort of the nimitta is because five senses disappear, the sixth sense manifests, gets strong. Please share your thoughts on the contents of the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And that particular book describes only one person who remembered that that transition. So it is an example, it's not what everybody does, and that's one of the problems there. And because of that, it's only about one person who died, and other people experience different things in different orders. And also, the most important part is because of that book, that they said that when a Buddhist dies, or anyone dies, you should not touch them for, I think, so many hours. And that's not really fair, because many Buddhists, when they die, or they're on the point of dying, they really want to donate their organs, you know, to people who need them much more than you do. You know, so, you know, you've got all this, especially if you die when you're young, like me, that there you can donate your heart, your liver, and all these other organs, your eyes, or your corneas, or whatever. And then, why can't we donate these? Especially kidneys. I'm not sure if this is true, but I heard it that there's no dialysis centers in Spain. The reason is because they have so many kidney donors. So if somebody has a failed kidney, they can just get an organ transplant. And I've been to dialysis centers in, I think, Malaysia. I remember going there and just talking to a few Buddhists, because some of the Buddhist temples were sponsoring them. And people have to spend hours on these machines. And to be able to have, like, freedom from that is wonderful. So it's great to be an organ donor. I carry my organ donor card around with me. And they can have whatever I want, but if they want. But I think, please don't get my brain, because if you get my brain after I die, you start telling stupid jokes. But that's one of the interesting parts of my organ. I'm going off the subject as usual, about the, but anyway, a lot of Tibetan lamas now, I understand, said, look, compassion is more important. So please, when you die, you can touch the body with compassion and just ask permission, and then you can actually harvest the organs. And to make use of those, out of compassion for other beings who need these things more than you. But I remember reading a book about heart transplants, and it had some really strange stories with it. And it really starts to stretch the data about rebirth, and also about sort of, you know, the memory. Where is it stored? Because one of the cases was a young girl, maybe 9, 10, 11 or something, who had a heart transplant. And, you know, she, you know, had a successful operation. But when she, you know, was well enough to go home, she always complained of these nightmares, these recurring nightmares. And the doctor, first of all, said it's just the trauma of the operation. But the mother didn't buy that, because it was the same nightmare of, like, going to a dark place at night and being murdered. And she wanted to find out, well, where did this heart come from? You know, was it from a murder victim? But, of course, the doctors were forbidden by their rules from letting on. So instead, the mother herself went to, you know, the local police district and said, notice, you know, my daughter is having all these memories of being murdered. She was a recipient of a heart transplant. And the detectives in charge of the, you know, homicide division were really interested, because it matched little they knew about an unsolved murder. And of course the police had the ability to get the information of that heart donor, and it was this murder victim. And on the basis of the information supplied by this girl from her nightmares, which she could recall very clearly. So they found the culprit, and he confessed to the murder of the original owner of the hut. Weird, but true. So, where was that memory stored? Was it, some of it was somehow stored in the cells of the heart? Is that memory like a hologram stored in every part of your body? But of course, those memories, they disappeared after a little while, when the rest of the ordinary memory took over. Or was it a case that because that was a heart, there was actually connection there between the original owner of the heart? After a while, she totally just, the little girl was separated totally from any memories or any connection with the person who owned the first heart. So, interesting. And this is the last question time I will do. So, you'll have to find the answer to that riddle yourself. Anyway, it's good to be an organ donor. Is it true that we have impressions of the time before birth? I had an impression occur to me some years ago, and I think during the time I was meditating a lot at home, or a time when I fainted due to weak health, that I had chosen this time in particular to be reborn. Yes. I also saw an impression of monks trying to live in the time of the Buddha in forested areas. Great. The impression I received was those monks will not be me, but I will be sort of associated with that setting. Can such remembrance happen? Yes, of course it can. And so sometimes, I don't know if it was the time of the Buddha or shortly afterwards, but, you know, the monks were there, and sometimes that impression is very strong on you. And you do have impressions before the time of this birth. And, of course, that sometimes, I don't know if about you, but the first time I saw a monk, it really shook me. What is this? This is amazing. This is important. And I was born in England. No one in my family could spell Buddhism. Let alone know anything about it. So that was certainly sort of something which obviously came from previous lives. And of course, this was only told to me by one of the monks a long time ago in Chithurst Monastery, that they said that one of their supporters was in the town of Southampton, could have been Portsmouth, one of those two cities. And they had a little child, and the first words the child said, when it was the age to start speaking, it saw a Buddhist monk and said, "Bhikkhu." And that was the first word it ever said. And how it knew that word, unless it was from past lives. If all positive and negative equal one whole and balance itself out, how does karma work then? How karma works is you can lessen bad karma by making lots and lots of good karma. And they always say that any bad karma you've made, if you put it into a glass of water, it makes the whole so salty you can't drink it. But if you dilute your bad karma by putting it into a swimming pool of water, then you won't even notice a change in taste. So that's why the Buddha said you can dilute bad karma. But some people have done lots of bad karma. That's just too much to dilute. So I'll tell you the loophole, the easy way. I shouldn't say this, but you let it go. You let go of your bad karma. And even, I've had some great discussions with psychologists He said, no, don't you need to actually to address, to bring up those bad things of the past and to deal with them before you can let it go? I said, no, this is the stream winner thing. Once you're a stream winner, you've got the achievement of stream winner, or the fruit of stream winner, then all the bad karma, lots of the bad karma of the past can't reach you. It's only a tiny little bit can. And they call it a hosi karma. It's gone. You can't get reborn in the lower realms anymore. And for many years I thought, how can that be? And it's because you're kind to yourself. You find out that, you know what, you know, this thing which you take to be a self, it's just a process, it's an empty process. Once you realize that, it's so easy to forgive and let go. Even now, the doors of any hell realms are always open. You can walk out any time you want, as long as you forgive and let, and learn. The power of forgiveness is huge. And I sometimes wonder, why is it that people can't forgive themselves? They made a mistake, they've done something stupid, learn from it and carry on. It doesn't help anyone by punishing yourself and feeling bad and feeling bad about yourself. It's those people who have lack of self-worth are the ones who just get into addictions. They can't stand themselves. Get drunk, take alcohol, you know, watch pornography, whatever it is, they just do stupid things. Why is that? Because they feel bad about themselves and they've yet to forgive themselves. So they seek that punishment. It's good I go on to this, because I never went into it when I said about that nun who forgot to, couldn't forgive herself, thought she didn't deserve the jhanas. And of course, that stops you doing a lot of progress. And it's, when you understand how it works, it's just one of the maddest things which a human being can do, to think they need to be punished, instead of acknowledging, learning from it, and letting it go. So, one way of doing that's easy to say, positive, negative, how does karma work then? So one thing you can do, because letting go of karma, forgiving, is easier said than done, especially to yourself. You say, oh, forgive me. Not enough. So you have to do ceremonies. So I invented the ceremony, which, sometimes you take sort of a well-known procedure in psychology and you expand it and make it a little bit more effective. And again, when I do go to these conferences, I went to this conference in Sydney of psychologists. And when I mentioned this procedure, oh, they really got into it. They just started writing it all down so they can use it on their clients. So I said, one of the most important things, if you've got some unfinished business of the past you feel guilty about, your bad karma from the past, you have to acknowledge it. Bring it up. Write it down on a piece of paper. But then, in true Ajahn Brahm, stupid, weird fashion, I said, but don't use ordinary paper, because there's so much stuff to write down. You know, just an ordinary sheet of paper won't be enough. And the paper's expensive. So get this piece of paper, which we all call toilet paper. Get a whole roll of it. It's really cheap. Is it?
Yeah, not cheap.
Well, I never buy any. It all comes. But it's much cheaper than this stuff. You know, in Thailand, instead of having tissues in a box, we had the tissues in a toilet roll. It was actually much cheaper and the same stuff. But because it's toilet roll, and put it in a nice box like this, which is scented. Actually, the toilet roll is scented as well. But anyway, they put it in this and just charge extra money for it. But anyway, the toilet roll. So what you do, you buy a toilet roll. It's worth it anyway. It's much cheaper than going to a psychologist. I think, is that true? Okay, good. So you get toilet roll. And then you've got to write it down. And the most important thing is the type of pen you use to write it down. Should be felt tip, dark brown. You've already realized the association. You write down the bad things you've done, your bad karma, in dark brown ink on toilet paper. A lot of psychology works because of association. And so as you're writing it down, all the terrible things you've done in your life, your bad karma, you're writing it down, dark brown ink, on toilet paper, and makes the association with the other dark brown stuff which goes on toilet paper. And you all know that even the most environmentally sensitive human beings on the planet, the chairman of Greenpeace or Save the Foundation, they never use both sides of the toilet paper. So wasteful. A tiny bit of dark brown on a toilet paper and you flush it away. Because it stinks. You'd be crazy to keep dark brown stuff on a piece of toilet paper, so this is making that association. What you're writing down in dark brown ink on the toilet paper is SHIT. And you're keeping it around, your bad memories and your bad stuff you've done. And you stuff so much of it in your pockets and keep it. So you write it down on the toilet paper first of all, as much as you can. And then, once you've written it down on the toilet paper, you've acknowledged it. Now you have to do the letting go ceremony. Just saying I let go is not enough. You've got to do something to reinforce the message. Like a person when they get married, they commit to one another, they have to go through a ceremony, you know, a commitment ceremony, you know, in front of the relations and friends or something. When you're dying, yeah, you die, just throw the body away, but no, we need to do a ceremony, a funeral ceremony, to give respect to a person's life. So, and the graduation, work so hard, you pass your exams. So have a ceremony, it reinforces what's happening. And so, we have to do this ceremony, the letting go ceremony. And it's done in the little room, because it has to be personal and private letting go, called the toilet. And there you go into the toilet cubicle, and you sit down, you don't flush it yet, you read it first of all, to reinforce. And to remind yourself, what am I keeping this for? And then, you open the lid, and you put the piece of paper with all your bad karma on it, the things you've done. And then, you press a button. The last part of the ceremony. And it goes, and out of your life forever. Do a letting go. Now you might think that's another Ajahn Brahm joke. It's not a joke, it works. Associations. So why do you want to carry around the bad karma of your past? It doesn't help you. It doesn't help others. You let it go. But please, don't do that in Jhana Grove toilets, not in your cottages. Otherwise, I know you've done so, but it's must. The toilets will be blocked. The servers will be in trouble. So that's actually how we can let go of karma. Why can't we keep the good karma? And sometimes, why does bad karma keep happening to us? When we get negative, we actually just draw up from our bad karma account. It's actually, we resonate with it, like tuning in on the TV or getting the two email accounts. One is bad karma account, one is good karma account. We always keep going to the bad karma account. But if checking into the good karma account, you've got heaps of good karma, every one of you. The fact you've come here is a huge good karma. Why can't you keep using it? How you use good karma is reflecting on all the wonderful things you've done. Not the two bad bits, but the good bits in your past. Yeah, I made some mistakes. I've probably told the same story many times during this retreat. I've said bad jokes. I have done the morning chanting at the wrong time. I don't know what else I've done here, probably terrible things, I don't know, but I've done some good things as well. So I'm going to remember all the good things I've done. And then sometimes I do that, I think, well, you know, this retreat center, I built this. Oh yeah, that's pretty good. I remember all the good stuff I've done. And at this time I'll say this, and you know, building this retreat center with the builder, builders, they'll say, oh, no worries, it'll be finished in plenty of time. So the night before the grand opening, they hadn't finished. And especially the bamboo fallout, the grand opening, and then the start of the first meditation retreat here, Easter 2009. So it's just over 10 years this place has been opened. And by the afternoon, there's a big hole here. The bamboo floor installers hadn't arrived. And we couldn't get any. It was the start of the Easter weekend. They went home. It was that was big piece of concrete. We're having important people come in the next day, opening our new center. People have given lots of funds for this, and look, it was not finished. So what happens in a Buddhist temple when it's not finished? The monks come to the rescue. And they did. About 6 or 7 monks, they stayed up to about 4 o'clock in the morning finishing this off. So what you're sitting off, this little corner here, including the border here, was done by a group of monks overnight till 4 o'clock in the morning. They'd be working all day, work till 4 o'clock to finish it off. So that in the morning, everybody could come here and enjoy Jhana Grove Meditation Retreat Center. And they went, had a nap for an hour or two, then back for the ceremony. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And I thought, wow, they're not lazy monks in this place. Yeah, we work hard. And it's actually, and they had so much joy doing that. And I had much joy telling the story. So people can get in the way and make things difficult, but you can't stop good monks finishing off the project and making it work. So that's what happens when the good karma, when I think of that, when you think of that, just what does it do to you? It's not even your karma. It's a monk's karma. We rejoice in it. And that is free happiness. Free good karma by rejoicing in other people's good karma. You know, that's one thing I learned from the Sri Lankan tradition. But whenever they have the Katina ceremony, which is coming on Sunday, you know, some people, they come here, and they were poor, and they can't afford big donations or expensive robes or anything. But still, they're welcome. And they do a little procession around with the royal robes and other gifts and stuff. And even poor people, they also go along and say, sadhu, sadhu, anumodana. They rejoice in other people's generosity. And they get almost an equal share of the good karma. You do good things, and you rejoice in other people's good acts. So even poor people can make good karma. And that's really sweet and really nice. Just by rejoicing in other people's goodness. You rejoice in those monks who finish that and you get good karma. That's how karma works. A good attitude, rejoice in other people's goodness. And don't get pulled down by other people's stupidity. They make mistakes of your own stupidity. That goes on toilet paper, down the loo. Anyway, when one sees that one's judgments, opinions or views about things or events have turned out to be wrong, what to rely on? What to do? And of course what to do is, the ones you can rely upon is when the 5 hindrances are gone. Then you see clearly. Before then, just see where do that view and that judgment lead to. If it leads, you know, to pretty good things, leads to more happiness, more peace, and a lot of time you can test your intuition. Your intuition is always much more accurate than your reason and judgment. That works on something far deeper than what you've learnt in this life. Ajahn Brahm, you interpret the Buddha's Satipatthana refrain on the body, the rising and cessation, to refer to how the four nutrients come about. What is the insight on this? That is from the Satipatthana Samyutta. I don't interpret this, the Buddha said this. The two Satipatthana suttas, which most people know and quote, are pretty similar. It's the Mahasatipatthana Sutta in the Digha Nikaya and the Satipatthana Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. But in the Samyutta Nikaya, there's a whole Satipatthana Samyutta where they talk about the Satipatthana. And there they talk about rise and fall. What does rise and fall mean? Samudaya and Atagamana. And so that's what the Buddha said. For each of the four Satipatthanas, he said, seeing the Samudaya, it's the origin. It's not just seeing it come up, it's saying where it comes from. And that gives you the idea that where it comes from, the cause is stopped, then the result is stopped. You know, whether it's the body with the four nutriments. What are those? It's interesting, the four nutriments of the body. It's not just food. It's also basically experience, contact, will, and consciousnesses. And especially like the experience, the sense contact. Because if somebody is in a coma, say, and they've hardly got any sense contact at all, their body is about to die. So that's why it really is useful if you want to keep them alive, if it's not sort of a terrible, terrible injury, but there's a good chance they may recover from it, stroke their limbs, get them some sense contact, talk to them. Because if you keep their sense contact, their sense experience going, then there's a good chance they will come back again. But if their five senses are just totally shut off, they can't feel in the body, they can't hear, see, smell, touch. If you want me to come back again, then put a baked bean in my mouth so I can get the sense contact. That's only joking, obviously. But the sense contact is an important part of keeping the body going. And of course we all know about will, the will to live and the will to die. Sometimes people give up. I've seen this so often in my life that when somebody, their wife dies, say, and their husband doesn't last that much longer. It's just almost that they're not a reason for them to be alive. There's too much is missing. And they just pass away. And the other way around too. So the will to live, to keep themselves going, disappears. Anyway, so that's actually where the few nutriments come. So have a look at the Satipatthana Samyutta in the origins. That's right, the rise and fall, or what it's called, I think. Arising and passing away. On the other hand, the four nutriments are not specifically referred to the body, only by the subsistence and arising of a being, food, sankara, will, contact, and experience. And so craving causes the arising of the four nutriments. How does this fit to the Satipatthana refrain? So you have a look at the Satipatthana Samyutta. My Dhamma teacher told me that the refrain, the arising and cessation, refers to anicca. That is to see the impermanent nature of the body, vedana, citta, dhamma, and thus relinquish clinging for that. Is she correct? It's more than that. It's anicca. Just anicca is not seeing like the waves on the surface of the lake down there. That's so obvious and so simple and superficial. Anicca is sitting by that lake And not just seeing just waves on the surface, but actually seeing the whole lake disappear. And all the land and the sky above vanishing. That is not supposed to happen. That challenges your understanding of reality to the core. To become enlightened, to get even streamlining, is a big experience. It's like having a kick up your backside. Not what you expected. Big. So that's one of the reasons why. Whoa! I never saw that coming. So that's anicca. Something which was there is gone. No longer there. Ooh, that's interesting. Ajahn, how do I know it's really nimitta or it's just the eyes playing tricks with us? E.g. rolling back upward sides, etc. You use one of the iPads. Or the eye shades. They have different words for those. Because it's usually eye shades on Singapore Airlines, but sometimes they call them iPads in the United States. And that's when, some time ago, Burr, she asked me, said, have you got any spare iPads? I said, no, I'm not an outlet for Apple or... He said, no, iPads. I said, well, I've got my one, which is, it's like a tablet, just so I can do the sutras. And... now iPads. And he said, no, they mean the eye shades. Oh yeah, we've got heaps of those in there. And so, being a tricky monk, I went to see one of the monks and said, do you want a new iPad? Really naughty monk. Said, oh yeah, please, yeah. Okay, well, right, I'm from. That's not an iPad. Okay, so then you actually know you put it in front, and on your, a few people I see wearing them, and that means it's really sure, this can't be a trick, this is, you're actually seeing something. It's also one of the reasons, designing this hall, see those windows at the very top, I want them as high as possible so the chance of you getting direct sunlight into your eyes is very minimum. If you're sitting here facing this way and seeing the light through here, if you're looking up to see the sun. So a lot of times people are meditating. If you see a light coming through here, it's not the sun. What is the meaning to see things as they really are? If you get jhanas, then you'll understand what it means. You'll be able to really seeing things as they truly are, as it truly is. Is it seeing things as anicca, dukkha, anatta, to dispel wrong views of permanence, bliss and self? You all know what anicca means. You know what dukkha means. You all know what anatta means, don't you? You've learnt all of that. You know, you've been to sutta classes, you've read all the books, you've been to talks, you've been around Buddhist societies and monks and nuns and teachers for how many years? So do you know what anicca means? You know what dukkha is? What does dukkha mean? What does anatta mean? So you must all be enlightened. You think you know. But do you really know? If you did, you would be an arahat. You'd be able to, tomorrow morning, allow me to mix all the food together. And it'd be perfectly okay. So, that's the problem there. Anicca, dukkha, anatta. Do you want to hear an Australian joke? Yeah, it's pretty quick. Anicca, dukkha, anatta, walk into a pub. That's the start of a joke. In the United States, say, anicca, dukkha, anatta, walk into a bar. So keep it American or English? So. Okay. Anicca, dukkha, anatta, walk into a pub. And dukkha looks around and said, this bar is so dirty and terrible. This bar sucks. Which is like bad. No, not good. So anyway, and And it just said, don't worry, it will change. And Anvita said, who said that? Okay. You asked for it. Anyway, so we think we know anicca. We think we know dukkha. We think we know anatta. That's a problem. So, that's why you need something strong, like a jhana, to really understand what they are. They are not what you think they are. So you ask me, what are they? You've got to find out in jhanas, for goodness sake, then you see as they are. Ajahn, did the nun at Bodhinyana Monastery finally achieve any breakthrough for nimitta jhanas? I think her story is a really good lesson for many of us. We don't tell about monks or nuns' great breakthroughs. We only tell about their problems. No, actually, that she disrobed, but later on she ordained. Dear Ajahn, how to discriminate different between drowsiness, dullness, and tiredness? Okay, if afterwards you're full of energy, really happy, then it's usually between drowsiness, dullness, and tiredness. One is like because you're physically exhausted, you know, you've been doing a lot, you've even been thinking too much, so your brain is exhausted, and the dullness is just boredom. You don't know how to generate nice energy inside of you. And again, one way of developing nice energy is recollection of Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and I did it a weird way by thinking of you're the Buddha. The Dhamma, remembering some of the most amazing teachings you've experienced in the past. Teachings which just really grab you and say, wow, that is amazing. There's no that time, I think I've already mentioned it early on in this retreat, seeing Ajahn Chah and him telling me, why? And he said, the answer's nothing. Every time I remember that, and recall it, that just boosts of energy. That overcomes tiredness. It's inspiration. Inspiration is a great way of overcoming tiredness and dullness. You're inspired. What you're doing, what you're part of. And, inspiration really gets me every time. Sometimes you see just, someone comes up to me and says, Ajahn Brahm, if it wasn't for you, I'd be dead. And they really mean it. And they tell me about it. And that really inspires me, what this Dhamma actually does in this world. Inspiration of actually really getting the Bhikkhuni Sangha going again. Inspiration of building monasteries in places. So that monastery down in Albany, which, you know, is the focus for the Katina this year. I went down there. It's an inspiring place. And all these amazing good things which happened. Even like the inspirational story of that first book, Opening the Door of Your Heart. You know where that came from and how it worked? So, you know, all these stories, which, you know, I tell you, the two bad bricks, open the door of your heart, the monster in the emperor's palace, and the emperor's three questions, all those ones. So I teach them for a long time. And then this lady in our Armadale group came up one day and said, thank you. I was going through a really difficult divorce. And it was because of your stories, I did not commit suicide. I thought about it many times. But your stories just kept me sane until all of the trauma of a divorce, you know, just eventually passed. Thank you. But she said to me, it's almost a crime, Ajahn Brahm, that you don't share those stories further. You have to write them down and publish them in a book. And I said, I'm too busy. And I always recall this woman. She was really smart. She knew how to get me on board to write that book myself. What she did, she said, well, I'll write a few stories. And she gave them to me after she wrote them. And they were terrible. I think she did that on purpose. And so, well, you can't publish that. So I decided I have to do it myself. I think she was really smart. She outsmarted me there. So I had to do it myself. And so, okay. So I think I was having a couple of weeks retreat. And I decided, a couple of weeks retreat, I would just spend an hour, just an hour every day, just writing them down. That's what I did. I wrote them down. An hour every day. And after 2 weeks, I finished half the book. 54 stories. I still got the manuscript, which I wrote out. Who's got it? I think Cecilia's got it at the moment. And it's hardly a mistake on it. Just wrote it out, just in a long hand, just wrote it, and the stories just flowed. It was because I was getting good meditation at that time. You just let it come out and just didn't change anything. And I think that I took a break and then did the last 54 stories. And I got one of the friends over here who could actually use a computer. I didn't have a computer, let alone be able to use it. Typed it out for me. And I was going to Melbourne to give some talks. The first stop after landing at the airport was go to Melbourne University to give a talk. And so I said, can I have the disc, the CD disc? You know, just in case. I didn't know anybody in Melbourne in the publishing industry, but I thought maybe I could ask them. Somebody might know somebody who knows somebody. But I didn't need to ask at all. After the first talk was finished, this lady came up, and I'll always remember her name. It was a very unique name. Magnolia Flora. And she said, I work in the publishing industry, and I like your talk very much. If ever you have a book you want to publish, please let me know. And this is, I'm not exaggerating. I just, in my bag, here you are. And she was really gobsmacked, surprised. And so that was where Opening the Door of Your Heart started. And of course, it was it last year. Last year I was giving some, I think the talk was, I think in Box Hill Town Hall or somewhere. And just I was saying hello to people and signing books, and this girl came up to me. She said, hi, Ajahn, you remember me? I'm Magnolia Flora, she said. I hadn't seen her for years. And she said, I got cancer about 2 or 3 years after the book was published. That's why I lost contact with you. I had to leave that job. But I used your book. I'm in full remission. Thank you, thank you, thank you. It's wonderful just to see an old friend like that and just the story of a book. You just didn't have to send it to publishers. No rejection notices. It says you gave it in and then just there it happened. That inspires me. And I said, so I think of things like that and just, well, okay, let's get meditating. So that's actually how you inspire and you get some good karma from your past and you really get into it. How do you meditate using feelings, piti sukha, as the object of meditation? Just that, like that. Inspiration, feelings of, you know, just right now, just energy going through my body, feel really happy and joyful. And then, piti sukha, just stay with that, it's joyful. Don't be afraid of it. And it just grows. It's easy to focus on what's pleasant. Based on your observation, do you see there are indeed more women retreatants as compared to men? I don't observe gender. So I think if you do count, there's usually more women retreatants here, I think. I don't know what's in it, this. You should know, Eileen.
I don't know.
By the country, I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah, more women.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah, okay, yeah. But, so what? Because when it gets into the mind has got no gender. The gender is to do with the body. The mind is beyond gender. That's why that some people remember their previous lives in the opposite gender. And there was even this one monk in the time of the Buddha, he actually changed his gender. It was an automatic. And I thought that was really weird until somebody said that some medical professional said, yeah, that can happen. It's extremely rare. But actually you have agenda change naturally without, you know, going to Bangkok or anything. And it just happens naturally. And this happened to this monk. And they said, well, now what should you do? And he said, well, you have to go to the nun's quarters because you know you're a nun. And then he said he changed back again afterwards or something because of some karma, really weird karma. But as a result of that, I think it was a man first of all, and then a wife. But anyway, it was about the attachment to a child. And what he said, because this was in one life, I was a father and a mother. That's right, it was a layperson first of all, a father, then changed into being a woman, and then, after being a woman, then changed back to being a man, and he said, this is too weird, I'm going to be ordained as a monk. And afterwards, he went around telling people, he said, well, I've been a father and a mother, and the attachment of a mother to her child is far greater than the attachment of a father to the child. He said that personal experience. You know, the bond is stronger, and he said that. He's not saying that one is better than the other. But if you really want to be people who come on the retreats, if you really want me to be gender discriminatory, in my experience, and I've said this, and it's not just to put one gender down, one gender up, it's just observation over many years of being a teacher, that women seem to have an easier time achieving jhanas, experiencing jhanas, than men. They seem to be able to get into a jhana more easily than men, but once the men do get into the jhana, they get the insight faster. So the men catch up afterwards. So actually there's no distinction. I see more ladies with jhanas, but then they don't really understand it that much. And the men make quicker progress once they've got the jhanas. But that's not in the suttas, not in the books anywhere. That's just my experience teaching. But one of the fastest ways to get into jhanas is to get your tattoos, like that pillow from me. That's just making it fun. Okay, based on your observation, even during Dharma talk on sutta studies, there are normally more female than male. From your wise influence, do you think there will be more devis rather than devas in the heaven realms? No. It all works out evenly in the end. The Bhikkhuni order was already perished in Sri Lanka before Buddhism came to Southeast Asia, was it? An ordination requires an unbroken line of lineage dating from the Buddha himself. What is the legitimacy of the restoration of the Bhikkhuni order in Australia in 2009? Why would women still want to ordain despite the inferior status of Bhikkhuni to the monks and the 8 extra rules in the Vinaya? It's a decent question, but one thing which I always thought that you needed both sanghas, bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. But actually, that there was a rule that first of all, the bhikkhunis could be ordained by bhikkhunis. There was a rule that the bhikkhus could only be ordained by the Buddha. But then the Buddha scrapped that rule and said, no, they can be ordained by other monks, by sangha of monks. The Buddha said, at first, the bhikkhunis could only be ordained by bhikkhunis. And then he said that they can be ordained by monks and bhikkhunis. And he never scrapped the first rule. And because he did not scrap that first rule, many people, many scholars, have actually noted that that particular choice was possible. You could ordain bhikkhunis by other bhikkhunis without the monks being involved. So, but also, bhikkhuni. we do know that the bhikkhunis travel from Sri Lanka to China, where we have the bhikkhuni lineage. And those ordinations of the bhikkhuni lineage are valid. And this is another thing about bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. There's no such thing as a Theravada bhikkhu or a Mahayana bhikkhu. They're bhikkhus who decide to practice Mahayana or Theravada. There's no such thing as a Theravada bhikkhuni or a Mahayana bhikkhuni. There are bhikkhunis who decide to practice Theravada. For example, we've got a really good connection with the Jogchi order over in South Korea, and very often some of the Korean monks have come here, and some, because as they stay the rains here, they actually just wear the local robes, which is Theravada forest tradition. When they go back to Korea, they wear the grey robes. Because there's hardly any difference at all. And as far as the Vinaya is concerned, it's compatible. So, Theravada bhikkhus, that lineage, it's not, there's only one Buddha, and it came from him, divided different robes, but the ordination procedure, the rules, keep that order alive. So, a lot of the current bhikkhunis, a lot of the current Theravada bhikkhunis use that connection and were ordained by Mahayana bhikkhunis. And that is valid. So, according to the regulations, the legalities, they were bhikkhunis. The lineage was never broken. Yes?
So why were there so much opposition at the time?
Big.
What you say now is correct.
Oh, yeah. Now, the opposition was there because it was political, it was emotional, it wasn't based on the Vinaya, on the legalities. And I got sucked into that as well myself. For years I thought, just how can we do this? You need another bhikkhuni, another bhikkhuni, Theravada bhikkhuni, to ordain other bhikkhunis. And because that was drummed into me, it was just, I couldn't see anything else. It's just like, how do you know that your judgment is correct? And because other people said that, I never really took it up and looked into it. But then once people started talking about ordaining bhikkhunis, you looked in and, hey, that's right. You can do this. And from that time on, that I saw, I think it was with an article by Bhikkhu Bodhi at a conference with His Holiness the Dalai Lama in Frankfurt or something. I looked at the article and, I don't believe people. I check it out and just, wow, he's got a point there. It can be done. And so once the legal obstacle was overcome, then it's the political obstacles. That people don't want it to happen. Vested interests. Fear of change. I don't know what people think, but that's when you actually look at it, it's a no-brainer. It's obvious that we should have equity. Basically, I look at my life now, I work my butt off. I need help. So I need bhikkhunis to help out. The more help, the better. Teaching and working and travelling. So, why not? So it's political and emotional, that's all. Silly, but there we go. Even, I'll let you in on a secret too. Introducing female Catholic priests. You don't need the Pope's permission to get a female Catholic priest. Someone told me about this some time ago, and it's actually true. Because the Pope has to live by what's called canon law in Catholicism. And the canon law only goes on land. It doesn't apply at sea. And so, you can ordain a woman as a bishop, or as a priest on the sea, and her ordination is valid. And then when she comes to land, she's a priest. That's how it can be done. So it's a legal loophole, but it's a legal loophole stopping it. So if you live by loopholes, you die by loopholes. Anyway, why would women still want to ordain despite inferior status of bikinis to the monks? Inferior? The status is what you, the lay supporters, ascribe to your sangha. If you respect them, support them, go to listen to their teachings, invite them to actually to talks, you give them the status. It's not intrinsic to being a monk or a nun. It's what you do. So that's, I pass the baton to you, that I can ordain these, the nuns. Now to give them respect, to invite them, that's your job. How do I lessen doubt about the historical existence of the Buddha? After all, he isn't a phenomenon that I can see, e.g. I look up at the sky and I see the sun. No, you don't. You see the sun 6 minutes ago. It could have already been disappeared by now. So, and if you look too long, so there's many things that I don't know what aircraft you're going back on, but do you believe in Singapore Airlines or Scoot or Qantas? You can't see it right now. But we use all of the supporting evidence. It's called like the principles of convergence. If you look at this way, look at that way, look at that way, the proof is pretty conclusive that there was a historical Buddha. There's more evidence, quite frankly, more evidence of the historicity of a Buddha than of Jesus Christ. Much more evidence of his existence. Anyway, lessening doubt I have will increase the faith I have. Evidence is huge. Dear Ajahn, can you kindly elaborate what would be not clearly comprehended under the gradual training? Is it being heedless in one's actions? Not clearly comprehending? Or not clearly comprehending under gradual training? For example, that sometimes you're meditating. Why are you meditating? Is it to become, get like what happened in the jail, the first time I went there? When so many people, Bunbury Jail was the first jail I visited, 105 people came to my meditation class. There was only about 110 prisoners in that prison. That was amazing. You get so many people came to learn meditation from me. And in the middle of my class, someone stood up, put their hand up, a huge fellow. It was so big that when they interrupt you and say, can I ask a question? Say, yes, sir. Yes, what do I do? He became a really good friend afterwards. And I got some nice stories about him. But anyway, he said, is it really true that through meditation you can learn how to fly over walls? You wouldn't believe it if it did actually happen. And they'd all come there. That's why they come to learn meditation. They weren't clearly comprehending the purpose of meditation. And of course I said, well, you know, it can happen, but only special people. It takes many, many years of practice. Then the next week only 3 people turned up. That's example not comprehending the purpose. Just to let you know, there really is an airline in Nepal called Buddha Air. Yeah, I've heard about that. So not the real Buddha Air. In the real Buddha Air, if you sit in your seats and you're doing absolutely nothing, you relax to the max. And everything happens. You don't have to do anything. And the flight attendant comes up and said, sir, What would you like to drink? We've got 1st Dharma, 2nd Dharma, 3rd Dharma, 4th Dharma today on the menu. So, now I'll have a 3rd Dharma today, thank you. And later on in the flight, they come up and say, what would you want for your main course? We've got streamlining, once returning, non-returning, full enlightenment. What do you want? I say, oh yeah, I'll have, I can't become enlightened yet because you know, I've got some debts to pay off and so. I'll just become a once returner, please, thank you very much. And they say, like, you know, in the pavilion at McDonald's, when you order something, do you want fries with that? They say, do you want psychic powers with that order, sir? It all comes to you, Buddha. But where does it go to? Buddha air will never land. It will disappear. Like MH. What is that? You know my theory of that disappearing airline? I don't know why no one else has actually thought about this. That there's only one person I know on the planet who can make a jet aircraft disappear. Sorry?
The pilot.
No! It was David Copperfield, the magician. He should be investigated. Anyway. Is our goal, if our goal is not to be reborn, what is the Buddhist view on marriage and procreation? Also, what is the Buddhist view on LGBT? May all beings be happy and well, including LGBTQI and plus. I think there's a few more there, but what's wrong with LGBTQ? And again, as well as ordaining bhikkhunis, I remember the first gay person I ordained as a monk. He's a well-known gay. He wasn't hiding anything, he didn't have to come out, he'd only come out years ago. And he wanted to become a monk, a really nice fellow. And I asked him, you know, what I asked him, you know, you want to be a monk? He said, yeah. And I just asked him straight, well, what happens if some really cute guy came into the monastery and you got hot with him? What would you do? And he said, I'll go back to my hut, lay down, I'll meditate. I said, okay, that's a good response. So, because you have to be celibate as a monk. So it's the same response which, like, a monk would say if a very cute girl came into the monastery. What would you do? And so, I gave him a chance. He's a lovely monk. Very wise, very compassionate. And is he Mahatera now or something? He's been a monk a long time, this monk. I won't say who he is. But if you see him, what a wonderful thing that was to ordain him as a monk. No problem at all. Very kind, very wise. So as long as you can keep your vows of celibacy, why not? That's what I say. Anyway, it worked. And he's been the first. We've got a few gay men who have become monks, and they caused absolutely no trouble at all. They were a jewel in the Sangha. And views on marriage and procreation, it's, well, if no one gave birth to young Buddhists, some of those young monks now, when I pass away, will have no Buddhists to look after them and serve them food. So sometimes it's good to get some more people up here to look after the middle-aged monks when they get old. If you didn't have any children, what would happen? No, seriously. It's interesting that I read this article recently that people said, well, you can have a baby if you wish, but they sometimes have a dog or a cat instead. And I thought that was an original idea, but they call them like fur babies now. They haven't got a name for them. Have a fur baby. Which means, the number one, they don't cost you so much with school fees, having a fur baby, a little dog or a cat. And they don't throw as many tantrums. They don't ask for the keys to drive your car and wreck it. There's many advantages. And they give a lot of unconditional love. Fur babies. Much easier to look after a dog or a cat. I'm serious. People actually consider that and they think, wow, it's actually an alternative as an outlet to actually for my compassion and kindness. You know, someone to love and care for. And some of those, I've had articles about this, some of those dogs and cats, that their love is unconditional. And they teach you so much. So, it's up to you. A famous teacher in the USA says the five aggregates literally means bricks or compounded. The candace literally means maybe something, but even like the word gay, what does it mean? It just means happy. So you can't just take a word and how it was used when it was first coined. You actually, how it's used in context. Does not refer specifically to what constitutes a being. In the context, it does. He claims that the Buddha did not say that instead the five aggregates is what we cling to. And we fashion our experience in one way or another in the five aggregates. Is that what the Buddha taught? No, the Buddha said specifically there is not something outside the five aggregates. You are the five aggregates, and the five aggregates vanish, you go. You are the five aggregates, and even the clinging is within the five aggregates, not separate from it. That was in the Chula Wedala Sutta. The Buddha teaches to avoid fools and to associate with the wise ones, for obvious reasons, because many promising young people's lives are ruined for mixing with undesirable persons, people like drug addicts and criminals. But I have heard criticism of this admonishment of the Buddha to mean to ignore these fools who probably need help and counsel. What is your take on this? It's wonderful to be able to help others, but you've only got a certain amount of right energy. And as somebody once called us, like vampires, in the sense that if you counsel, if you help, if you go out there to serve, there's so much you can do, but you find at the end of the day your energy gets sucked out. And unless you've got a huge store of energy or a way of regenerating your positive energy, sometimes you get so sucked that, I remember there's one, the wife of a Buddhist, who was such an amazing counselor, and she was a Buddhist in the early days, and she was just so smart and so wise and so kind. But then one day her husband came to the temple and said, "Have you seen my wife? She's disappeared." And she was found on the bank of a river. She jumped off the bridge. She committed suicide. She gave so much, she had nothing left for herself. And for counselors, you do need somebody else to look after you. Almost like to debrief. Otherwise you totally get sucked dry. And even myself, I just work really hard, but I make sure 2 weeks of the year minimum, I get into my cave and I disappear to get your energies back up. I'm saying that to Venerable Chanda, Helen, make sure that she takes time out, otherwise she'll get exhausted, burnt out. Monks can be really compassionate. And they can be wonderful people, but they get limits as well. And I saw that firsthand with Ajahn Chah. You know, he had this water on the brain and he had a stroke. And people say, why did that happen? You just saw him, he was up early in the morning, on arms round after lunch, talking with the lay people. And the lay people went and was talking to the monks. And then talking to the receiving guests all afternoon, talking, doing amazing talks. And then in the evening, talking to the monks, and after the evening talk, he'll be sitting in his hut answering questions from the monks. That was his life. Just giving, giving, giving. And people sucked him dry. No energy left. So I saw that. I got pictures of Ajahn Chah, and got to be very careful. Sometimes you have to say no. So I can't do any more. So that you can do more tomorrow. So that's helping. Yeah, please, do what you can. It's really important. But there's a limit to what you can do. Dear Bhante, my Sikh friend is very interested in the Dhamma. He loves your talks and meditation instructions, and I am more than happy to share the Dhamma with him. He said he is a Buddhist Sikh. But I did caution him that if he goes deep into Buddhism, he will encounter teachings contrary to Sikhism. Actually, the Sikhs are just some of the nicest people. I love Sikhs. I don't try. Even when I was a layperson, I really enjoyed their character. And in fact, Venerable Nibbuto, you know, he's Sikh by birth. And when I told that story of his village, Mrs. Kaur, and obviously it was a Sikh tradition. So his father's come and had a look at him. He's no problem at all. So, why do you have to be the religion of your birth? You may be born in Sikh culture, but you can bring a Buddhist, a Christian, a non-believer, whatever. We have this wonderful choice now. So you can be a Buddhist, even like they have this thing called Jew-Buds, Jewish Buddhists. And they're Jewish by birth, by race, maybe, but they follow Buddhist traditions. What's wrong with that? And there's even, this retreat center, or one of the, I think the first time, the earliest time was a retreat center which we had just before we brought this in North Perth. And this devout Muslim came to join our retreat. She came in a hijab, and as soon as she came into the retreat center, according to her rules, she said, I can take off my hijab now. And she meditated with everybody. Nobody really knew who she was. And at the end of the retreat, she said, wow, this is really good. I can't see anything wrong with this. And so she put on a hijab and went back home. And so, you know, trying to see if she can introduce this to her friends. Can't we actually get the best out of every religion? Anyway, he said he's a Buddhist Sikh, but I did caution him that if he goes deep into the Buddhism, he will encounter teachings contrary to Sikhism. I once brought him to Ajahn Brahmadi's talk on Majjhima 1, the Mudapariyaya Sutta. Oh my goodness, that's one of the deepest of talks. Even the monks didn't understand that when the Buddha first gave it. And I asked him afterwards, would a Sikh audience be elated at what the Buddha taught? Obviously no. Now he's very busy at work to attend any talks and retreats. And I told him perhaps he should stick to Sikhism, a religion of peace and what it's so far that I've come to respect. So am I being skillful in that way? No, he should become a Buddhist Sikh or a Sikh Buddhism or just join. I'm sure he can get lots of joy out of this. And who knows? Mudapariyaya Sutta, that's a very difficult one to actually to start with. So now come to a nice meditation retreat. Really nice. For the sutta we discussed today on volition, that must be an old question. Do volition? When do we do volition? Some time ago. Anyway, is it appropriate to say that it is not that one needs to make no volition effort at all, but rather the establishment of each prior factor is a supporting condition for the next, starting from non-negativity, and the effort to arouse the next factor is much less if the prior effort has been established. No, you find it's a natural process. Does a tree decide that now I'm going to put forth a new branch? Does it decide that now it's going to put forth a flower? Now the flower is going to make a bud. Now the bud is going to make a fruit. Or is it a natural process? Sometimes human beings think they're in such control that we think everything we choose when and how to do it. And to make the point, even when I was a student, this happened in the Psychic Research Society, which I was a member of, with Bernard, came the disciple, a close associate of Stephen Hawking's, and also Jeff Perry, who was the consul of Macau for a while. I thought he was going to aspire, basically, because, you know, that he was very physical. He captained some sort of hockey team or something for the Cambridge. And I thought, was he really the consul, or was he MI5? You know, there's another monk. I shouldn't really say who he is, but you know, he's quite well known, still a monk. His sister had a job in the city. Would go there every day and come back again. And eventually she retired. And then after she retired, her brother found out. She was working for MI6. Not as some secretary in the back. She was front line. Because she had this amazing ability. She could look at a document and memorize it perfectly. So they would send her in the Soviet Union when that was going. And they'd, you know, some spy had got the document and she'd look at it. And then she'd go back to London and just reproduce it word for word. Really quick. Didn't need actually cameras. And so this monk's sister was a spy. Things you don't know who a spy is. They look ordinary. They have to have some sort of cover. And I shouldn't say this, but, you know, I tell the people in Perth. You know, Ajahn Brahm, he goes overseas and he brings back all this money. What a wonderful cover it would be for a spy. A Buddhist monk. And this here, it's not fat. It's my utility belt. All my secret weapons are in here. And it's just covered over, you know, to look... I wouldn't be a good spy, I can't keep a secret. But when you start thinking, hey, that's amazing. And I'm sure there should be a movie one day about the Buddhist monk as a spy. Actually, if they need to go overseas, they're not really a good Buddhist monk spy, because a Buddhist monk will just read your mind and they get all the information. You don't need to interrogate anybody. Anyway, I shouldn't go there, I'll get in trouble. Could you share some techniques on how to evoke the idea of non-self during meditation? Thanks. Yeah, it's just let go of any measurement of yourself. Someone once asked about, measuring? And I started quoting the physicist and the engineer, Lord Kelvin. And he said the only way to control nature, he was one of the pioneers of technology, the Industrial Revolution. The only way to control nature is learn how to measure her accurately, first of all. Which meant they spent a lot of time having the standard meter, which is, you know, it was in France, and they moved it into some quiet place somewhere. Standard weights. Clocks which were accurate, because once you could measure and standardize lengths and times and weights and things, then you could start technology. And so he then asked, or they asked me, what do you think of that? And I, of course, for insight, you turn it the other way around. What would happen if you don't measure? You can't control. Which is one of the reasons why people want to get all your bio data, all of your, browsing history, as much to measure you, because once they can measure you, then as controlled as possible. The only way to control nature is to measure, first of all. But if you can't measure, you can't control. Next. That's why people don't like ID cards. Too much measuring. So no fear of control. What about meditation? If you don't measure, your progress. You don't measure your mind. You can't control it. You have to let go. Did you have a good meditation now, bad meditation? Just a meditation, that's all. If you don't measure it, there's no control, and there's no control, your idea of self vanishes. One of the words for the mind, which people, mind consciousness, which people think is their self, is mano. Mano, the mind. And if you create from that noun the verb, it becomes manati, to measure. Mind is what measures. So when you don't measure, you start to vanish. Back to physics. It was the Greeks who invented or suggested the idea of atmos, the indivisible. You know, you can't atmos, I think, is like to slice it or something. You can't slice it. The indivisible thing which makes up stuff. And the Greeks and the Indians were very connected. Their language is part of the Indo-Aryan group of languages. Atmos, the atom. What word does that sound like? What's the Sanskrit word for atta? Atma. Atma, atom, are they related? You bet they are. The indivisible building block of nature. The indivisible building block of human being, the Atma. However, this great Kiwi, Rutherford, split that atom and found that it wasn't indivisible. But he wasn't the first, 2500 years ago in India, a Buddha split the Atma, split the self into five khandhas, and saw each one of those is not substantial. That's what the khandhas are, splitting the Atma, like Rutherford split the atom. That's what a monk does when he's in a retreat. Wow, just messes around with words. Wow, this is great, look at this. No question. Whoever wrote that is amazing. Actually, there's a bit of pencil mark on here. Can you describe the four jhanas? Hey, I've done that all the time. Where were you? It would have been done. Ah, you probably were in jhana when I was talking. That's why you never heard it. The practice of Anapanasati fulfills the Satipatthana in that that one is eventually mindful and aware of the four focuses of mindfulness as the practice of Anapanasati develops. In the Sutta, the Buddha teaches that in and out breath is classified as a body. The purpose of Satipatthana is to dispel the four vipalasas, that's the delusions of permanence, bliss, self, beauty in the body, feeling, mind, dhammas. How does the in and out breath as a body lead to this insight? No, this is part of understanding. This is how the Buddha wanted you to focus on any of these four. And first of all, to having restrained the five hindrances until you get the jhanas. That's what the Buddha kept on saying. There is no wisdom without jhanas. You need the jhanas to be able to see things as they truly are. If you don't get the jhanas, you will not see things as they truly are. Don't just look at one Satipatthana Sutta. Look at the whole mass of Buddha's teachings in the suttas. I said many of those. What's the only meditation a Buddha recommends? Four jhanas. So you have to put everything together. And yeah, you may think, oh, it's just more work, or, you know, you haven't achieved a jhana yet, but satipatthana, that's much easier to do, honestly. But to the full satipatthana is hard to do. Remember it said, I remember the first time I read a book on the Satipatthana Sutta, written by, I think, Venerable Sona and another monk, Sri Lanka monk. They say they'd gone to Burma because they've heard that if you practice a Satipatthana for 7 days, you become fully enlightened. And I think they were there for 7 weeks or something, and they were still not fully enlightened. So instead of actually practicing Satipatthana anymore, they decided to write about it, to translate the book into English. But the Buddha did say that if you practice Satipatthana for 7 days, you become enlightened. How come there's not more enlightened people who practice Satipatthana? It must be because they are not following the instructions. The Buddha doesn't lie. What instruction haven't they followed? Vinaya loke abhija dhammanasan. They haven't abandoned the five hindrances. They haven't lessened them yet. They're still doing Satipatthana where the hindrances are far too strong. So, the purpose of Satipatthana is not to dispel the four vipalasas, the delusions of permanence, bliss, self and beauty in the body. The purpose of Satipatthana is to prepare the way for the jhanas, which prepares the way for seeing things as they truly are. Satipatthana is not a be-all and end-all in itself. Otherwise, the Buddha would have taught a one-fold path. The chanting never stops now. It's like a background musk that keeps playing when eating, walking, etc. Help! Why? It's beautiful, the chanting. You obviously an enchanted person. It will stop, unfortunately. From what I've read, Ajahn Chah seemed to run a strict monastery. What you've read and what it was like are totally different. You know, I once read that book by Paul Breiter. I knew Paul Breiter when he was a monk, Wawapanyo. And when I read that book, he said, was it Dear Father? Or sorry? Venerable Father. And when I read that book, I said, what monastery is he talking about? What monk is he talking about? I was with Ajahn Chah much longer than Wawapanyo or Paul Breiter. What is he talking about? That's not my Ajahn Chah. And Ajahn Chah's funeral. All the months we had this discussion. What did Ajahn Chah really teach? And we couldn't agree what Ajahn Chah really taught. And until my predecessor, Ajahn Jacaro, he came up and said, each one of us has got our own Ajahn Chah. Each one of us has got the teachings which we remember, which were important to us. And we just forgot those other teachings because they weren't relevant to us. So there's as many Ajahn Chahs as there are disciples who remember him. And of course, now we have another Ajahn Chah, the Ajahn Chah which you get from reading the book. That's why that Ajahn Chah I can't remember. That's not how I remember him. A strict monastery? No way. He was very kind. And as long as you are practicing, no problem at all. So it wasn't, he never hit me or scolded me or shouted at me. And all the time I was there for 9 years, he was very kind and caring. That was my memory of him. Why these differences exist, I think, because different people who remember. You co-authored a book with a Singapore master, Guo Chun. He was sued in Singapore for various financial misappropriation issues. The newspaper even reported him going to a luxurious hotel in the singlet, staying overnight with another guy. What are your thoughts on this? Well, apparently that he was, I think it was, what was his name? Handaker. You know, she suggested to me one day, why don't you do a code book or something? I said, oh yeah, no trouble. And I didn't really take it seriously. But then on one of the tours of Indonesia, it was with Master Gwajon. And I didn't know him from, he seemed a nice monk. So we just, for a week or two, we gave talks. It was only afterwards I heard about there was some problems there, so I asked him. I asked him specifically, what happened? And maybe you can take this off the recording afterwards. I just asked him, look, I'm not beating about the bush. Did you have sex with anybody? He said, no. He said, that's one of the reasons why they asked him to join in this falling is flying. It was like two monks. I was accused of breaking the Vinaya because of ordaining bhikkhunis, and he was ordained, accused of financial misappropriation issues by the temple he was staying at. And his take on it was no, that they were following him around, and the person he was one of his old school friends was visiting, invited him just to over to the Sands Hotel, and invited him just to have a massage, because he had a bad back, therapeutical massage. And newspapers saw that, put it in the newspapers. And the sued for financial misappropriation issues, that was the temple he was at, and that was just, he said, to get rid of him. And he wasn't found guilty. As far as I know, he was found innocent. But that's a trouble. That's a way to sometimes get rid of a monk. Sue him. You know, even weird that when I was expelled from Wat Pa Phong for the ordination of bhikkhunis, there was all accusations like that against me in the Thai newspapers, that I changed the constitution of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia against the Sangha's wishes, and just to get my own way and to amass wealth and fame. And that's actually why there's a similarity over there. But maybe I was more well known, and you know me for a long time. I'm a good monk. You check me out for a long time. But sometimes if people want to get rid of a monk, what do? It's actually sex, money. And that's what they usually do. They try and find faults in you. And it was also the case, there's another example of that, which actually makes me, please, innocent until proven guilty. And that was where there was, he used to be the secretary of Ajahn Chah in Wat Pa Phong when I first ordained. And first went to stay in Wat Pa Phong. So you'd have to go and see him to do the visas. And he was really stressed out with that job, being the secretary, as Ajahn Chah became more famous. And so after a while, he just ran away from Wat Pa Phong and went to live in a quiet monastery. He's a good monk. And just as he lived in the quiet monastery, his meditation got very well. He's an excellent Dharma teacher. He became quite well known, and one of his disciples, lay disciples, was a gentleman called Thaksin Shinawatra, who became the Prime Minister of Thailand. And as the Prime Minister of Thailand, he had many enemies. And to get at the Prime Minister at that time, they also tried to get at his teacher, this monk. And I remember they showed me the photograph. It's a photograph of this really beautiful Thai woman going into this building, which is supposed to be his kuti. But it wasn't like a kuti, like a monk's residence, like my little cave. It was only one room. It was a place, there was a reception area for guests, there was other monks staying there, and this monk, he lived in the top, that was where his bedroom was, and there were other people there at the time. He was just totally set up. And it wasn't the full picture of what had happened. So what this monk did, instead of fighting all these accusations, he just, for the second time, just disappeared and lived a quiet life as a simple monk, instead of being the teacher of somebody famous. So I've seen that a few times, and sometimes it's Why do people not give even monks presumption of innocence? As far as I know, I've talked about to many people in the Buddhist Fellowship about this. Is there real proof that he's guilty or done something wrong? Or is it just association? So I haven't found any sort of proof. I talked to this monk about it, and I talked to others, and even the Wisdom Publications who published this, I talked to them about it. And if you, and they had a look into it and said, can't see any damning evidence. Anyway, and what happened to the Anagarika ex-girlfriend abducted by an alien? In the end, did he stay on to become a monk? No, he was an Anagarika for a while and then he left. Where is he now? I think he is. A few of the monks, the younger monks, you know, still talk about him and still contact him on. Are you okay? There's only. How's it going? Are you really tired? It's 20 to 10, but there's only 4 questions left. Shall we keep it going? Anyone who's tired, you can actually just go to bed. Ajahn Brahm, can one get too attached to the joy and bliss of jhanas? I read in Sutta Majjhima 138, the analysis of qualities, and the Buddha does talk about that. The first critique, the distinction of mind by pursuing mental objects, and that the best insight will be to see all 5 aggregates as not I, me, and mine. You can be attached to the jhanas, but that just stops you going from non-returner to full enlightenment. I mentioned the 5 lower fetters, but the 5 higher fetters, or the 5 high, yeah, the higher fetters, the last 5 of the Samyojanas includes the attachment to jhanas and attachment to arupa. But I think many people will be satisfied with that at the end of this life, to be a non-returner and be that close. That is not the real problem. The jhanas. The jhanas are used to cross the stream. Only after you've crossed the stream do you throw away the raft. And many people throw away the raft in the middle of the stream. So once you cross the stream, you know, with the jhanas, then you can let them go. But of course they're just default state. When I meditate and feel very still, I feel an energy surging up to my head. Can I know what is this sensation and what I should do with it? Just enjoy it. But the most important thing is to try and that joy, that energy, please see if you can separate it from your body. So it's not in your body anymore. It's in the mind. So the piti sukha should really just be confined to the mind. Not into the body. It's what I told them, it's like a leaky bucket. It just gets you all wet. The water should be in the bucket, and if it leaks into your body, yeah, it's nice, but it's the wrong type of energy in the wrong place. So when you practice according to even like the Anapanasati Sutta, if you start off with the body, with watching the breath, it becomes very delightful, and the 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th part of Anapanasati, it is, you're watching a chitta sankhara. It's how the mind is looking at the breath. That's why the joy, the piti sukha, is actually with the mind. And then when the 9th stage of anapanasati, you experience the chitta, and all that energy is right in the mind, it doesn't leak out into the body, and so those energies going up and down, what some people refer to as even kundalini, that is not in the body, it's in the right place, the mind. And it's far more powerful, far more effective. If it goes in the body, sometimes it can be a bit interesting and fun, but it also just messes around with your body. So, keep it in the mind. 2 to go. Did the Buddha do healings? There's only one time he did a healing, and that was, what was it? Most of the time he didn't. Because there was one time when, was it Kisa Gotami? Her little baby, her boy had died, and she was so upset and said, now the Buddha, you got all these powers, can you do a healing? In other words, bring my kid back to life. And what did the Buddha do? He said, oh, well, to get your kid back to life, I will need 3 mustard seeds, each from a house where no one has ever died. And she said, oh, that's easy to get. So she went to the first house, knocked at the door. Can I have a mustard seed? Yeah, sure. What do you want? Oh, but before, has anyone ever died in this house? Yeah, of course. No, grandma died last year. Sorry, I can't take it. And in the second house, third house, fourth house, in these old villages, you even try that in Singapore. Knock on the house, you've got a mustard seed. Anyone died here? Especially in the older quarters, of course. Many people have died. And so after a while, she found she couldn't get the mustard seeds to cure her kid and bring it back to life. And she realized that this was not a medicine, but a skillful means. She realized the death of her child was not the only death which happens in life. When someone close to you dies, it's like they're the only person in the world. And you can't understand why not everybody else is suffering and is in grief. Your whole world has collapsed. And you think everyone else should share that grief. It's like the death of your person, the most important person in the world. But when you understand that everybody dies, and one child is one amongst thousands, tens of thousands, she realized death is part of life. And so she buried her child or cremated it, went to the Buddha, said, thank you, thank you, thank you. If you'd have brought my child back to life, the child would have died one day, or I would have died. But you cured something much deeper, my delusion of attachment and not letting things go. I realized my child must die one day. I accept that. I let it go. And she became a bhikkhuni, and one of the arahat bhikkhunis. So wise, Kisar Gotami. Brilliant. I think she was one of the ones who also, she was meditating and there was a candle burning, or an oil lamp or something, and the wind blew it out. And that was the moment she broke through to full enlightenment. You are just, as I mentioned already, Elton John is a Buddhist. At least he wrote Candle in the Wind. He understood about Princess Diana or something. But that's who you are. Just a candle in the wind. Gone forever. Anyway, what is your opinion of practices of setting metta and energy for healings? Devotees are being asked to do them in WhatsApp groups for... Oh, they don't say. Oh. For Bhante Hai and Bhante Kumara. Yeah, it's those monks in Malaysia. Of course, sometimes it can help. So the mind has power. Quickly, that when I was in the Psychic Research Society as a student, you saw a person doing this experiment. They put someone under hypnosis. They had a stick with a 4-inch nail on the end. And they convinced the person under hypnosis it was red hot. They touched the nail on this person's skin. He screamed in pain because he believed it was red hot. It was just an ordinary nail at room temperature. But then I saw a blister came up, a wound. There's no physical reason why a wound should have occurred, because that nail was just ordinary temperature. But because he believed it was hot under hypnosis, red hot, the wound was created by the mind. When I saw that, as a physicist, if a nail at room temperature can create a wound under hypnosis because of belief, it can uncreate a wound. It can heal a wound. It can shrink a tumor. You can do all sorts of things. The mind is all powerful. And that opened up a huge area of interest for me. Ajahn, I understand. Okay, this is the last question. Until I get another one. I understand not to have solitude, but why can't I have silitude? That's what I call solitude. People like to be in solitude, but I like messing around with words. Solitude is being by yourself. Solitude He's saying sorry for everything. Oh, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have asked that. I'm sorry. I've kept you awake too long. It's 10 minutes to 10. I do apologize. I'm sorry. I told the wrong jokes. Honestly, you know, if I was really honest, I'm not sorry. I thought it was a good idea at the time. I tried my best. So sorry. And too many people live in solitude. So, then, silitude. Put a bit of silliness in the world. Would not taking oneself serious be accurate to the Buddha's teaching, asking sincerely? Taking yourself seriously is actually just solidifying your idea of a self. Silitude, playing, is one of the great ways to developing insight. You're playing, exploring. I was told that when I was at Cambridge University doing experiments. They say, play around with the instruments. Do things differently. Be silly. Because there you make the breakthroughs. Play is creative. Being serious is just going through the old ways of doing things. It's one of the reasons why silitude in places like Google and Facebook, where people do silly things on purpose, there you find you have breakthroughs. Yay! Sadhu! 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 Okay, so time to go to bed. Have a nice night.